Hello, this is the Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of small animal cardiology to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the studies relevant to small animal cardiology that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from August 9th, 2026 to August 15th, 2026. And it looks like we've got a fantastic selection of clinically relevant highlights for you this week, Sarah, starting with a couple of really interesting papers from the emergency room.
Indeed. Let's dive right in.
First up, we have a paper by Ehrlich and colleagues from Tufts University in the USA, published in the Journal of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care. It's a prospective observational study.
The aim was to evaluate dogs with hemorrhagic pericardial effusion for the presence of hyperfibrinolysis, basically, excessive breakdown of blood clots. They took blood samples from 16 dogs with pericardial effusion before pericardiocentesis and ran a special coagulation test called a tPA-activated thromboelastography, or TEG.
And the results were pretty dramatic. They found that 14 of the 16 dogs, that's nearly 88%, were hyperfibrinolytic. The median clot lysis at 30 minutes, or LY30, was over 50% in the sick dogs, compared to just 1.3% in the healthy control dogs.
Well, the N is small at just 16 dogs. And it's an observational study, so it shows an association, not a cause. But the p-value is less than 0.001. That difference is so stark, it's hard to argue with the finding itself.
Clinically, this is really important. We manage these dogs all the time, and some of them re-bleed after the pericardiocentesis. This study suggests that hyperfibrinolysis could be a contributing factor. It makes you wonder, should we be considering antifibrinolytic drugs like tranexamic acid in these cases? This certainly provides a strong rationale for a future clinical trial.
Next, also from the Journal of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care, we have a study by Knopf and colleagues from the Freie Universität Berlin in Germany. This was a larger prospective observational study looking at SIRS and sepsis in dogs.
Right, they followed 172 cases that met the criteria for SIRS. The goal was to describe the underlying causes, the rate of organ dysfunction, and the outcomes. They found that gastrointestinal diseases were the most common trigger, accounting for about 35% of cases.
Methodologically, it's a decent sample size from a single university hospital. They found that the coagulation system was the most frequently affected organ system, which ties in nicely with the last paper, actually. But there was one finding that I found peculiar.
Ah, you mean the survival data? Overall short-term survival was almost 78%. But dogs with sepsis, meaning SIRS with a documented infection, actually had a better survival rate than dogs with non-septic SIRS.
Exactly. It's counterintuitive. The abstract doesn't offer a clear explanation for this finding. As a single-center study, we do have to wonder about generalizability. And this odd result makes me question what other factors might be at play in their specific population.
I agree, it's a head-scratcher. But even so, the paper provides valuable data for the clinic. It's a strong reminder that GI disease is a huge driver for SIRS, and it reinforces that we need to be vigilant about monitoring for coagulopathies in these critically ill dogs. It also gives us some solid numbers to discuss prognosis with owners.
Moving on to the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association. This is a study by Forsyth and colleagues from Purdue University in the USA. It's a prospective pre-test, post-test study on medetomidine-vatinoxan, which is marketed as Zenalpha.
Yes, a drug many of us are starting to use. They wanted to see exactly what it does to the heart in healthy dogs. They took 21 client-owned dogs and performed echocardiograms, blood pressure monitoring, and a one-hour Holter before and after sedation with the drug.
And the results were quite sobering. Compared to baseline, the drug caused a significant reduction in multiple measures of systolic function, including ejection fraction and fractional shortening. It also dropped blood pressure and heart rate, and prolonged the PR and absolute QT intervals on the ECG. In fact, over 60% of the dogs developed or had worsening AV nodal conduction issues.
62%? That's a lot.
It is. From a method standpoint, using each dog as its own control is a valid design. However, there's no comparison group that received just medetomidines, so it's impossible to parse out how much of this is due to the vatinoxin versus the medetomidine itself. Also, blinding of the echocardiographer was not reported.
That's a fair point, Sarah. But the clinical takeaway here is crystal clear. Vatinoxin is a peripheral alpha-2 antagonist that's supposed to mitigate the cardiovascular side effects of medetomidine. This study shows that while it might help with blood pressure, it still results in significant cardiac depression. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. We cannot be using this drug casually in dogs with known or suspected heart disease. Our last paper is from the Veterinary Journal by Sun and colleagues at Huazhong Agricultural University in China. This was an exploratory pilot study looking at sacubitril/valsartan in a feline model of cardiac hypertrophy.
A model, Alex. Not actual HC-M. They took 12 healthy cats and induced pressure overload hypertrophy by constricting the abdominal aorta. The cats were then split into three groups: a sham surgery group, a group with aortic constriction and no treatment, and a group with aortic constriction that received sacubitril/valsartan.
And the results looked very promising. After 30 days of treatment, the sacubitril/valsartan group had lower NT-proBNP and troponin levels, reduced left ventricular wall thickness on both echo and CT scan, and less interstitial collagen deposition on histology compared to the untreated group.
I'm just not buying it, Alex. The N is minuscule. Four cats per group. Four! And the aortic constriction model creates hypertrophy, yes. But it isn't the same as the complex genetic disease we call HC-M. The spin here is quite heavy. The conclusions feel far too strong for such a small, experimental study. Blinding was not mentioned either.
I hear you on the stats, Sarah. I really do. But in the field, this is still a step forward. Sacubitril/valsartan is a massive deal in human cardiology, and we have very few options that reverse remodeling in cats. This study, despite its limitations, is an important proof of concept. It shows a plausible benefit and gives us the ammunition to argue for a large, properly funded, multi-center clinical trial in cats with spontaneous HCM. It gives us a little bit of hope.
That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster to stimulate your appetite, to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.